to me, it's a real heart-pulling story that goes along with the Native American story here. I've always felt that. And when the two entities collided at that battle scene just outside of Temecula, it was two people groups whose hearts had been broken, who had suffered great losses, and they were actually having to redefine themselves as communities of people. And they both came out winners somehow.
I'd like Kevin, first of all, to share a little bit about why he was so excited to come to Temecula in the first place, so that the people that are listening can kind of get a vision of what was happening with the battalion at that point and why your area is so significant in the story. So Kevin, if you'll just go ahead and share that.
So in 2007, I did kind of a drive-through of key locations along the route. And I went reverse. I started in Utah, drove to California, and then worked my way back through the trail, driving to some key areas. Now, I knew Temecula was the second settlement, if you will, that the battalion got to in California. The first, of course, being Warner's. And then they don't talk about meeting anybody else till they get to Temecula Valley. And then they bump up against the Pechanga tribe, who are burying the dead from the Temecula massacre. And they don't, you know, the lack of knowledge causes problems. And so they're not sure if they're friends or enemies, and everybody's getting ready to go to fight. And, but, you know, cooler heads prevail and they don't. So, and then I was aware in my reading that the burial ground had been preserved by the tribe. And I thought, well, that's cool. I mean, you know, how so often the First Nations are written out of the story, if you will, and they lose any visibility in the story. So to have that touchstone, if you will, of the burial location, and I know it's not really publicly promoted and it's not really talked about a lot from what I've seen. I don't remember that there was a sign there at the burial ground, because they don't want anybody to...
You don't want one. The Pechanga people don't want one.
I understand that. For me, they've escaped, the battalion has escaped the desert, and now they're in the coastal regions and things are greening up, and you know, they're all excited about it. And to me, it was just this confluence of a change of hope, a change of situation, meeting people of different cultures, and almost going to war, and then realize, oh no, we're friends, or at least we could get along. And so I think that's why I was kind of excited about Temecula. It had an old history that dated all the way back to the battalion. Not well known. Everybody talks about San Diego. Everybody talks about, you know, Santa Fe, but who knows anything about Temecula? And yet it's a cool place. And I happened to be in Temecula on a Sunday. And I went into the LDS building, and I'm standing in the foyer, and I look to my right. Oh my gosh, here's a painting that someone had made of the battalion arriving and tribe members greeting them. Hmm. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Never even heard that it's there.
Oh, I'll send you a copy of the picture.
Please. We'd love to see it. Yes.
Yeah. And so then, you know, and then to meet up with you guys, Dan Miller, is just, it reinforced the love I have. Unfounded, no reason to have this thing for Temecula, but I do. I like Temecula.
Also, I want to correct something. We do not refer to the Native people here as Pechanga until after they were put on their reservation. They were the Temecula Native people.
Okay.
Because the name Pechanga came about when they were put onto the reservation.
When it was formed.
And when it was formed in 1882. And it's a play on words, you know, as many Native names for people or places have to do with characteristics, like I might be called She Who Sings, or, you know, Daryl may be called Works With Hands or whatever. Pechanga means dripping water. And it was an insult to the United States government because they gave them a place with only dripping water when there are flowing streams elsewhere.
Oh my goodness. So how far away is the reservation then? From
the reservation?
It's adjacent.
Yeah.
To the city.
We drove over there.
Okay. Yeah, it's like 4 miles from the History Center.
But the Pechang, the dripping springs, there is a dripping springs. It's a rock and it forms, you know, it's basically a spring and ultimately it turns into a, not a river, but a wash.
A river.
When it rains, if it rains here.
Okay, so to get this right then, in 1846, they would have been known as the Temecula Tribe. Okay.
Yes.
And prior to that, did they have a different name for themselves?
No. And it was basically family groups all over our valley before the settlement by non-native people. Yeah, so they were called the Temecula Natives. And Temecula, Temeco, means where sun touches sand. That was a description of our valley, where sun touches sand. Okay. There have been other romanticized meanings like where the sun shines through the mist. But as they've done more linguistic studies in recent years, they have insisted that it is where sun touches sand.
So let me ask then, so is the Pala Reservation the same situation that didn't really come into existence till 1882-ish?
No. So 1903, they had their Trail of Tears from Warner, and they were put down in Pala with two other tribal groups. So you have three tribal groups who don't necessarily get along, and they had to make a community of themselves. And they were actually of different linguistic roots too.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
So the original trail, I had another guy tell me, well, he thought maybe the original trail went over down the valley that Paula's in now. But no, okay.
No.
It didn't seem.
Yeah, that was a rumor, but no, that was not the way.
Okay.
They're wrong.
Now, I want to tell you one other thing. Our contact person at the Pechanga Cultural Resources Department, who is not a native, she's Anglo, she informed me that they have new information about the massacre and that she will be presenting that soon. She has to get permission. And we are going to have her as a speaker probably after the first of the year in 2023 at our Historical Society. And that will be available on Facebook, and we will also put it up. We have a YouTube channel now, so you will be able to view what Pechanga has as their most recent information research.
But what we do know about the massacre is that we had mistakenly thought that it was the whites that were massacring the Indians, but it was Indian against Indian. You know, there were a lot of fights over boundaries and hunting grounds and hate and so forth. So it was, far as we know, the Kuya to the north were fighting.
Into the canyon and then ambushed them.
Right.
Yeah. And that's in Parker's book.
So this battle that we were talking about, or massacre, is one of the things that touched Kevin's heart as well. And that's why he wanted to come to Temecula, especially. Well, I know why I love it. And that's because of you guys.
Well, I mean, before
I didn't know any story, so I was just along for the ride following Kevin. Kevin was my Colonel Cook.
Your support.
Wherever he went, I was behind. So getting to meet you was delightful.
Interesting thing, I wanted to just talk about the cemetery, or the burial ground, as it's been called. We have drawings of it early on with a cross. Now, as you would know, the Catholic Church would not have allowed it to be there if it wasn't a consecrated cemetery. So I'm sure we have no record that it was the cemetery for Temecula before the eviction. And then subsequently, all the wood fence around it all deteriorated. But the ranchers took railroad ties and marked off and had barbed wire around it. And so it had been preserved. And the interesting thing, as they had plowed around it, as you know, the ground gets lower, lower, lower as you plow it. But the cemetery had raised because of that.
Because of the respect that the ranchers had.
So it's kind of interesting that it's been the white people that have preserved the cemetery all these years.
And the last stone, and maybe the only stone, because they probably had wood markers before, was from a man named Cushman, whose ancestry went back to the Mayflower. And he was married to a Native woman. And in the early 1990s, that stone was removed and taken to the Pechanga Cemetery. I want to tell you also about a funeral that we went to, probably, I'm guessing, in 2008. It was Johnny Manoa's funeral. Johnny Manoa was part of the tribe, but he was also Mormon. And at his funeral in the Mormon church, or whatever you call it, steakhouse, his son gave a recitation honoring the Mormon people who came through in the battalion and related it to the tribal group that they were members of. And it was a very precious, precious, I'm almost crying when I retell it. It was really special, wasn't it, Daryl? And, you know, when they asked his family to come up to the front to sing Amazing Grace in the Lewisanian language, a third of the congregation got up and sang. You think about all those people who may not have been saved, their lives may not have ever happened had the battalion not come through. You know, I don't know. It just is a very precious, precious thing to us. We were both just bawling. It was just wonderful to see the two come together in one man and to have the story retold.
Do either of you remember how you first met Kevin?
Yes. Kevin, you had sent out a bunch of emails fishing for connections. And yep. I received one, and there were others in the area who I think we all responded. And then we all were going, well, who's the lead on this? And I said, I'd be happy to be, you know, the lead on it. So we all kind of coordinated our efforts.
And it worked wonderfully.
We thought so too. Yeah.
So I've been, you know, reminiscing, and we of course knew about the Mormon Battalion and that they came through here and we taught it, but we hadn't delved into the whole story, you know, realizing that basically it was a financial deal between Brigham Young and the president. You know, we had the Mexican-American War going on here, and he wanted to show his strength. And then I didn't even know that the battalion was a civilian battalion. I thought they were trained military men. Of course, I found out they were basically pressed into service, you know, and were not that happy about coming to California. It was interesting, of course, that they found out that the war was over and they wouldn't have to fight when they got to Temecula. That was good. All in all, it raised my awareness of what the battalion was all about. You know, that it was civilian, run by a military officer. What was his name?
Cook, by the time it got to
Cook. Cook, yeah.
I'd also like to tell you my story about how I learned about the Mormon Battalion. It was from the little booklet that Horace Parker wrote, and you probably have seen it, have a copy of it, about the Indian Massacre, I think is the title of it. It's a red, he called it a libretto. It's a small, thin little pamphlet that he made.
I haven't seen that.
Look it up. It's available online.
Paul Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R.
Yes, Parker. And he had interviewed Tony Ashman. Tony Ashman lived to be over 100 years old. And when Horace interviewed him, he would have been probably in his 70s, 80s, 90s. I don't know. But you can almost figure out. Parker would have written the book in the 1960s. And so what Tony Ashman told him is when he was a small boy, he interviewed people who had witnessed the massacre. So we've always thought that was a reliable source. And what I love about the story is that Horace Parker has a bit of the dramatic that I just love and I've always told. And it is, you know, as the Mormon, first of all, you start out with Brigham Young, and he prophesies that no one shall see death in a battle on their journey. And people came to what they thought was going to be a battle as they crested the hill into Temecula. And they suddenly realized, no, the prophet was right. It was not going to be a battle that would take their lives. And instead, they stood guard over the Native people who were burying their dead. And then there was something special that happened between the Native people and the Mormon battalion at that moment. God provided for both, you know? So being a woman of faith as I am, I take that and I seize that story, mm-hmm. and it becomes beautiful to me. So that was what I knew about the Mormon battalion, and then, you know, learned about where they marched to afterwards and that they found out that the war was over and so on. To me, it's a real heart-pulling story that goes along with the Native American story here. I've always felt that. And when the two entities collided at that battle scene just outside of Temecula, it was two people groups whose hearts had been broken, who had suffered great losses, and they were actually having to redefine themselves as communities of people. And they both came out winners somehow. And it was, you know, just by divine appointment that the Mormon battalion was there to help guard the people who were burying their precious ones who had been lost in the massacre. And, you know, it was also such a redeeming thing for the Mormon battalion to come and be honored after being burned out of Nauvoo and having no place to rest and being in winter quarters and being a people who were looked down upon by others. It was just like a stamp of approval that they were legitimate and that they were motivated by goodly, godly things. So to me, it's just, you know, my heartstrings are just pulled. I have tears in my eyes as I ponder those two people groups who just came together in an instant and created history.
Well, this is great. I guess one thing that you had triggered in my mind then was you became aware of the Mormon Battalion through this book, Mr. Parker's book. So when you got the letter from Kevin saying that someone was going to walk the Mormon Battalion trail, what was your initial reaction?
We were so excited. We were just so excited. And it was like, oh yeah, this is the right thing. Somebody needs to do this. We want to be part of it.
You definitely were part of it. Daryl, what was your reaction?
The same. Yeah. It's just like, oh, wow, that's great. Retracing the steps, you know, of the battalion was, I knew it would help bring a lot of things to light that had been kind of forgotten or lost.
I'll tell my version of how we met. Then we each share our vision of how it really happened, our perspective rather. I didn't know anything about Temecula, of course. I came along with Kevin. He said, oh, we're going to have dinner with the Farnbachs, and they've got some people that we're going to meet. And we had my dad with us, and we come into your museum, your little barn. And there are all these charming people that are just all about history and local history. And they were so kind to us. And they just took me in. I'm not a history person like Kevin is. I mean, I like it. I don't eat it and sleep and drink it like he does. And so it was fun to get to meet all of you. And you served us a yummy dinner. And we stayed and talked way late. And I think that's when I fell in love with you, Rebecca, with your story. And I hope that another time we can get to that on a podcast. That was my memory of coming in, being welcomed with open arms with these people who had no idea who we were, really, and just falling in love with your history. Mostly falling in love with the dedication and the commitment that you two had to fight for preserving your history. And a lot of people looked at Kevin and I like we were nuts for what we were trying to do. But when I saw you two, I was like, we're not crazy at all, you know. There are people that love their history and they want to save it and they want to share it with people and learn more about it. And so that's what I remember the first night. Rebecca, when we're talking about that first night, would you mind painting a picture for people? What your building is like and what we actually
sure.
went to that night.
We have a new red barn that was designed to look like a barn that had been dismantled a few paces away. And as part of a historic preservation project, we advocated by suing the County of Riverside and a multimillionaire developer down in San Diego to save the historic Bell Ranch headquarters. And so this was the implement barn, and it was rebuilt using some of the original materials and using a tin roof that was part of the Bell Company's actual tin from one of their buildings. So the first—
Let me speak originally. Originally, the barn was an open air barn. So it was a barn that they could bring equipment in with a horse, let's say, and drop it off, and then the horse could go straight on out. You know, there wouldn't be any backing up. So it had four of those bays that were open. One end actually had a corn crib, and one end had a piglet raising area. And it had a little raised area for loading and unloading dock. So, of course, they enclosed it for us. And but when they put the bathroom on the back, it's the same configuration as the little piglet area. So it's a replica.
Yeah.
But we're happy with it a lot.
Yes. Originally, it wasn't going to be our organizations to occupy. But after some negotiation, we rent the first one third of it for $1 a year from the County of Riverside. And the second two thirds, we have pretty much gratis after drawing up some legal paperwork. And that's our meeting
with
room.
With the developer, right?
Yeah.
And we sourced the tin for the roof. So it has original tin roof that is from numerous buildings around Temecula. So it's very secure. We have no heating or air, but we do have electricity.
And we can open doors.
What a charming place to come.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is open to the public for free as a museum on Sunday afternoons between 12 and 5. And we have a lot of families come in. We try to provide some hands-on things for children to manipulate because, you know, that's how they like to experience things. Mm-hmm. And also some visuals along the walls for adults to read at length.
We run a train.
We have a little kiddie train.
Yeah. And that train provides us with income you would not believe.
Really?
We are so self-sustaining. We continually run a $60,000 to $65,000 balance in our checking account.
And
we basically buy whatever we want. We bought a second train because we're afraid that one we've been using for the last 4 or 5 years it's the lawnmower, basically, with little red cars behind. But we charge $3 a ticket, and we get lots of kids that want to ride it. In that little train. So we've collected a lot more things than when you were here, let me tell you.
You'll have to come back and visit again.
I want to ride the train.
Yes, yeah. You would love it.
Yeah, me too, Dick.
And then we also have been, we were donated another stagecoach that a fellow put together. Not quite so fancy, you know, as the one that you saw, a smaller one. And we run that, we pull that with a tractor that we have, a 48 Ford tractor.
So kids ride in that too.
That we purchased. So we have a tractor now. So we have quite a few vehicles.
Where do you run it around? I didn't.
Bell headquarters. Bell headquarters on the other side of Coles.
Oh, okay. Okay. I got it.
So we designed it with a stagecoach route when we designed the layout of the site.
Oh,
with that in mind.
How fun.
You got to come back. You just have to come back.
So it is a real destination place for locals to go. And it's really fun. You know, we see a lot of families come out. Of course, wine drinking is the big deal. But they'll come out with their kids, and the kids can play in the grass and run around and so forth. And they can sit and have their meal.
If you go to VailHQ.org or .com, V-A-I-L HQ. You can see pictures.
We were talking about the first night. Rebecca, can you tell us about your memories of that evening?
Well, you know, I actually have the program from that first day.
Oh my goodness.
And I can scan and send you a copy if you like. But
that'd be great.
You recognize that picture?
Yes, I do. Right?
Okay. And it says that on Saturday, January 24th, from 1 to 5, people could visit the encampment, and that you had walked 2,000 miles to Temecula following the 1847 route, of course it's 46 and 47, of the Mormon Battalion, the longest infantry march in U.S. history. And then they could return from 7 to 9 p.m. for a historical presentation by you and with other local historians regarding the significance of the Mormon Battalion coming to the Temecula Valley. And I just remember connecting with you two.
It was a delight, of course, to have you come. One of the things that really stuck out was you said after 2 weeks on the trail, your straw hat broke. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And it just brings home the stress of what people went through to get to California. You know, you think, well, sure, their shoes are gonna wear out, but you certainly don't think their straw hat's gonna fall apart. Brought home that difficulty. It also, for us, we still have a Mormon Battalion display with all the mess kit and the blankets and so forth displayed prominently, things that we had purchased, you know, from you. And so, and we teach it, we don't go deep into it, but we certainly provide it, you know, for our museum. And the museum is going strong.
So excited to get that going and have the facility secured for long-term use.
Part of what we get to discuss today is helping people be more aware of what you have there in Temecula.
Oh, thank you.
In this episode, you may have caught a glimpse of how passionate Daryl and Rebecca are about history and the obligation they feel to help preserve it. But I hope that you will listen to the next segment, where you'll learn about the journey they took in order to be able to preserve the Vail Ranch and the history there in Temecula. It really is incredible. It's a David and Goliath story. And it shows what people can do if they take one step at a time.